Chapter 11. The World Message Consortium. The world is nearly all parcelled out, and what there is left of it is being divided up, conquered, colonised. To think of these stars that you see overhead at night, these vast worlds which we can never reach. I would annex the planets if I could. I often think of that. It makes me sad to see them so clear and yet so far. From Cecil Rhodes' Last Will and Testament, 1902. From their table by the window, she could see the downpour spattering the street outside. A soaked pedestrian, his collar up, gamely hurried by. The proprietor had cranked the striped awning over the tubs of oysters, segregated according to size and quality, and providing a kind of street advertisement for the speciality of the house. She felt warm and snug inside the restaurant, the famous theatrical gathering place, Chez Dieu. Since fair weather had been predicted, she was without raincoat or umbrella. Likewise unencumbered, Vega introduced a new subject. "My friend Mira," he announced, "is an ecdysiast. That is the right word, yes. When she works in your country, she performs for groups of professionals at meetings and conventions. Mira says that when she takes off her clothes for working-class men at trade union conventions, that sort of thing, they become wild. They shout out improper suggestions and try to join her on the stage. But when she gives exactly the same performance for doctors or lawyers, they sit there motionless. Actually, she says, some of them lick their lips. My question is, are they lawyers healthier than the steel workers?" That Vega had diverse female acquaintances had always been apparent. His approaches to women were so direct and extravagant, herself, for some reason that both pleased and annoyed her, excluded. And they could always say no without embarrassment. Many said yes, but the news about Mira was a little unexpected. They had spent the morning in a last-minute comparison of notes and interpretations of the new data. The continuing message transmission had reached an important new stage. Diagrams were being transmitted from Vega, the way newspaper wire photos are transmitted. Each picture was an array raster. The number of tiny black-and-white dots that made up the picture was the product of two prime numbers. Again, prime numbers were part of the transmission. There was a large set of such diagrams, one following the other, and not at all interleaved with the text. It was like a section of glossy illustrations inserted in the back of a book. Following transmission of the long sequence of diagrams, the unintelligible text continued. From at least some of the diagrams, it seemed obvious that Vega and Arkel Gelski had been right, that the message was, in part, at least the instructions, the blueprints for building a machine. Its purpose was unknown. At the plenary session of the World Message Consortium to be held tomorrow at the Elysee Palace, she and Vega would present for the first time some of the details to representatives of the other consortium nations, but word had quietly been passed about the machine hypothesis. Over lunch, she had summarized her encounter with Rankin and Joss. Vega had been attentive, but asked no questions. It was as if she had been confessing some unseemly personal predilection, and perhaps that had triggered his train of association. "You have a friend named Mira, who is a striptease artist, with international venue?" "Since Wolfgang Pauli discovered the exclusion principle while watching the Folies Bergère, I have felt it my professional duty as a physicist to visit Paris as much as possible. I think of it as my homage to Pauli, but somehow I can never persuade the officials in my country to approve trips solely for this purpose. Usually I must do some pedestrian physics as well. But in such establishments, that's where I met Mira, I am a student of nature, waiting for insight to strike." Abruptly, his tone of voice shifted from expansive to matter-of-fact. "Mira says American professional men are sexually repressed, and they have gnawing doubts and guilt." "Oh, really?" And what does Mira say about Russian professional men? Ah, well, in that category, she knows only me. So, of course, she has a good opinion. I think I'd rather be with Mira tomorrow. But all your friends will be at the consortium meeting, she said lightly. Yes, I'm glad you will be there, he replied morosely. What's worrying you, Vege? He took a long time before answering, and began with a slight but uncharacteristic hesitation. Or perhaps not worries, maybe only concerns. Well, what if the message really is the design drawings of a machine? Do we build the machine? Who builds it? Everybody together? The consortium? The United Nations? A few nations in competition? What if it is enormously expensive to build? Who pays? Why should they want to? What if it doesn't work? Could building the machine injure some nations economically? Or could it injure them in some other way? Without interrupting this torrent of questions, Lunacharsky emptied the last of the wine into their glasses. Even if the message cycles back, and even if we completely decrypt it, how good could the translation be? You know the opinion of Cervantes. He said that reading a translation is like examining the back of a piece of tapestry. Maybe it's not possible to translate the message perfectly. Then we wouldn't build the machine perfectly. Also, are we really confident we have all the data? Maybe there's essential information at some other frequency that we haven't discovered yet. You know, Ellie, I thought people would be very cautious about building this machine, but there may be some coming tomorrow who will urge immediate construction. I mean, immediately after we receive the primer and decrypt the message, assuming that we do. What is the American delegation going to propose? I don't know, she said slowly. But she remembered that soon after the diagrammatic material had been received, De Heer began asking whether it was likely that the machine was within reach of the Earth's economy and technology. She could afford him little reassurance on either score. She recalled again how preoccupied Ken had seemed in the last few weeks, sometimes even jittery. His responsibilities in this matter were, of course. Are Dr. De Heer and Mr. Kitts staying at the same hotel as you? No, they're staying at the embassy. It was always the case. Because of the nature of the Soviet economy and the perceived necessity of buying military technology instead of consumer goods with their limited hard currency, Russians had little walking-around money when visiting the West. They were obliged to stay in second- or third-rate hotels, even rooming houses, while their Western colleagues lived in comparative luxury. It was a continuing source of embarrassment for scientists of both countries. Picking up the bill for this relatively simple meal would be effortless for Ellie, but a burden for Vege. Despite his comparatively exalted status in the Soviet scientific hierarchy, now, what was Vege? Vege, be straight with me. What are you saying? You think Ken and Mike Kitts are jumping the gun?
Straight. An interesting word. Not right, not left, but progressively forward. I'm concerned that in the next few days we will see premature discussion about building something that we have no right to build. The politicians think we know everything. In fact, we know almost nothing. Such a situation could be dangerous.
It finally dawned on her that Vege was taking a personal responsibility for figuring out the nature of the message. If it led to some catastrophe, he was worried that it might be his fault. He had less personal motives as well, of course. She said, "You want me to talk to Ken?"
"If you think it's appropriate."
"You have frequent opportunities to talk to him?" He said this casually. "Oh, Vege, you're not jealous, are you? I think you picked up my feelings for Ken before I did, when you were back at Argus. Ken and I have been more or less together for the last 2 months. Do you have some reservations?"
"Oh, no, Ellie. I'm not your father or a jealous lover. I wish only great happiness for you. It's just that I see so many unpleasant possibilities."
but he did not further elaborate. They returned to their preliminary interpretations of some of the diagrams with which the table was eventually covered. For counterpoint, they also discussed a little politics, the debate in America over the mandala principles for resolving the crisis in South Africa, and the growing war of words between the Soviet Union and the German Democratic Republic. As always, Arroway and Lunacharsky enjoyed denouncing their own country's foreign policies to one another. This was far more interesting than denouncing the foreign policies of each other's nation, which would have been equally easy to do. Over their ritual dispute about whether the check should be shared, she noticed that the downpour had diminished to a discreet drizzle. By now, the news of the message from Vega had reached every nook and cranny of the planet Earth. People who knew nothing of radio telescopes and had never heard of a prime number had been told a peculiar story about a voice from the stars, about strange beings, not exactly men, but not exactly gods either, who had been discovered living in the night sky. They did not come from Earth. Their home star could easily be seen, even with the full moon. Amidst the continuing frenzy of sectarian commentary, there was also, all over the world, it was now apparent, a sense of wonder, even of awe. Something transforming, something almost miraculous was happening. The air was full of possibility, a new sense of new beginning. "Mankind has been promoted to high school," an American newspaper editorialist had written. There were other intelligent beings in the universe. We could communicate with them. They were probably older than we, probably wiser. They were sending us libraries of complex information. There was a widespread anticipation of imminent secular revelation. So the specialists in every subject began to worry. Mathematicians worried about what elementary discoveries they might have missed. Religious leaders worried that vegan values, however alien, would find ready adherence, especially among the uninstructed young. Astronomers worried that there might be fundamentals about the nearby stars that they had gotten wrong. Politicians and government leaders worried that some other systems of government, some quite different from those currently fashionable, might be admired by a superior civilization. Whatever Vegans knew had not been influenced by peculiarly human institutions, history or biology. What if much that we think true is a misunderstanding, a special case, or a logical blunder? Experts uneasily began to reassess the foundations of their subjects. Beyond this narrow vocational disquiet was a great and soaring perception of a new adventure for the human species, of turning a corner, of bursting into a new age, a symbolism powerfully amplified by the approach of the third millennium. There were still political conflicts, some of them, like the continuing South African crisis, serious. But there was also a notable decline in many quarters of the world of jingoist rhetoric and puerile self-congratulatory nationalism. There was a sense of the human species. Billions of tiny beings spread over the world, collectively presented with an unprecedented opportunity, or even a grave common danger. To many it seemed absurd for the contending nation-states to continue their deadly quarrels when faced with a non-human civilization of vastly greater capabilities. There was a whiff of hope in the air. Some people were unaccustomed to it and mistook it for something else, confusion perhaps, or cowardice. For decades after 1945, the world's stockpile of strategic nuclear weapons had steadily grown. Leaders changed, weapon systems changed, strategy changed, but the number of strategic weapons only increased. The time came when there were more than 25,000 of them on the planet, 10 for every city. The technology was pushing towards short flight time, incentives for hard target first strike, and at least de facto launch on warning. Only so monumental a danger could undo so monumental a foolishness, endorsed by so many leaders in so many nations for so long a time. But, finally, the world came to its senses, at least to this extent, and an accord was signed by the United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, France, and China. It was not intended to rid the world of nuclear weapons. Few expected it to carry some utopia in its wake. But the Americans and the Russians undertook to diminish their strategic arsenals down to 1,000 nuclear weapons each. The details were carefully designed so that neither superpower was at any significant disadvantage at any stage of the dismantling process. Britain, France, and China agreed to begin reducing their arsenals once the superpowers had gone below the 3,200 mark. The Hiroshima Accords were signed, to worldwide rejoicing. Next to the famous commemorative plaque for the victims in the first city ever obliterated by a nuclear weapon, "Rest in peace, for it shall never happen again." Every day, the fission triggers from an equal number of U.S. and Soviet warheads were delivered to a special facility run by American and Russian technicians. The plutonium was extracted, logged, sealed, and transported by bilateral teams to nuclear power plants, where it was consumed and then converted into electricity. This scheme, known as the Gehler Plan, after an American admiral, was widely hailed as the ultimate in beating swords into plowshares. Still, since each nation retained a devastating retaliatory capability, even the military establishments eventually welcomed it. Generals no more wish for their children to die than anyone else. A nuclear war is the negation of the conventional military virtues. It is hard to find much valour in pressing a button. The first divestment ceremony, televised live and rebroadcast many times, featured white-clad American and Soviet technicians wheeling in two of the dull grey metallic objects, each about as big as an ottoman and festooned variously with stars and stripes, hammers and sickles. It was witnessed by a huge fraction of the world population. The evening television news programs regularly counted how many strategic weapons on both sides had been disassembled, how many more to go. In a little over two decades, this news too would reach Vega. In the following years, the divestitures continued almost without a hitch. At first, the fat in the arsenals was surrendered with little change in strategic doctrine, but now the cuts were being felt, and the most destabilizing weapon system were now finally being dismantled. It was something the experts had called impossible and declared contrary to human nature. But a sentence of death, as Samuel Johnson had noted, concentrates the mind wonderfully. In the past half year, the dismantling of nuclear weapons by the United States and the Soviet Union had made major new strides, with fairly intrusive inspection terms of each nation soon to be installed on the territory of the other, despite the disapproval and the concern publicly voiced by the military staffs of both nations. The United Nations found itself unexpectedly effective in mediating international disputes, with the West Irian and the Chile-Argentina border wars both apparently resolved. There was even talk, not all of it fatuous, of a non-aggression treaty between NATO and the Warsaw Pact. The delegates arriving at the first plenary session of the World Message Consortium were predisposed toward cordiality to an extent unparalleled in recent decades. Every nation, with even a handful of message bits, was represented, sending both scientific and political delegates. A surprising number sent military representatives as well. In a few cases, national delegations were led by foreign ministers or even heads of state. The United Kingdom delegation included Viscount Boxforth, the Lord Privy Seal, an honorific Ellie privately found hilarious. The USSR delegation was headed by B.Yar Abukimov, President of the Soviet Academy of Sciences, with Gottsriedzer, the Minister of Medium-Heavy Industry, and Arkhangelsky playing significant roles. The President of the United States had insisted that De Heer head the American delegation, although it included Undersecretary of State Elmo Honeycutt and Michael Kitts, among others, for the Department of Defense. A vast and elaborate map in equal area projection showed the disposition of radio telescopes over the planet, including the Soviet ocean-going tracking vessels. Ellie glanced around the newly completed conference hall, adjacent to the offices and residence of the President of France. In only the second year of his 7-year term, he was making every effort to guarantee the meeting's success. A multitude of faces, flags, and national dress was reflected off the long, arcing mahogany tables and the mirrored walls. She recognized few of the political and military people, but in every delegation there seemed to be at least one familiar scientist or engineer, Annunziata and Ian Broderick from Australia, Ferdica from Czechoslovakia, Braude, Crebillon and Boireau from France, Kumar Kandrapurana and Devi Shukapati from India, Hiranaga and Matsui from Japan. Elliot reflected on the strong technological rather than radio-astronomical background of many of the delegates, especially the Japanese. The idea that the construction of some vast machine might be on the agenda of this meeting had motivated last-minute changes in the composition of delegations. She also recognized Malatesta of Italy, Bedenbaugh, a physicist fallen into politics, Clegg, and the venerable Sir Arthur Katos, chatting behind the sort of Union Jack one can find on restaurant tables in European resorts, Jaime Ortiz of Spain, Prebula from Switzerland, which was puzzling, since Switzerland did not, so far as she knew, even have a radio telescope. Bao, who had done brilliantly in putting together the Chinese radio telescope array, Vintergarden from Sweden. There were surprisingly large Saudi, Pakistani and Iraqi delegations, and, of course, the Soviets, among whom Nadia Rozhdestvenskaya and Genrikh Agankelsky were sharing a moment of genuine hilarity. Ellie looked for Lunacharsky and finally spotted him with a Chinese delegation. He was shaking hands with Ru Wenquang, the director of the Beijing Radio Observatory. She recalled that the two men had been friends and colleagues during the period of Sino-Soviet cooperation. But the hostilities between their two nations had ended all contact between them, and Chinese restrictions on foreign travel by their senior scientists were still almost as severe as Soviet constraints. She was witnessing, she realized, their first meeting in perhaps a quarter century. "Who's the old China person Vega is shaking hands with?" This was for Kitz, an attempted cordiality. He had been making small offerings of this sort for the last few days, a development she regarded as unpromising. She said, "You, director of the Beijing Observatory." "I thought those guys hated each other's guts." "Michael," she said, "the world is both better and worse than you imagine." "Huh? You can probably beat me on better," he replied. "But you can't hold a candle to me on worse." After the welcome by the President of France, who, to mild astonishment, stayed to hear the opening presentations, and a discussion of procedure and agenda by Dehir and Aboukimov as conference co-chairman, Ellie and Vega together summarized the data. They made what were by now standard presentations, not too technical because of the political and military people, of how radio telescopes work, the distribution of nearby stars in space, and the history of the palimpsest message. Their tandem presentation concluded with a survey, displayed on the monitors before each delegation, of the diagrammatic material recently received. She was careful to show how the polarization modulation was converted into a sequence of zeros and ones, how the zeros and ones fit together to make a picture, and how, in most cases, they had not the vaguest notion of what the picture conveyed. The data points reassembled themselves on the computer screens. She could see faces illuminated in white amber and green by the monitors in the now partly darkened hall. The diagrams showed intricate branching networks, lumpy, almost indecently biological forms, a perfectly formed regular dodecahedron. A long series of pages had been reassembled into an elaborately detailed three-dimensional construction which slowly rotated. Each enigmatic object was joined by an unintelligible caption. Vega stressed the uncertainty still more strongly than she did. Nevertheless, it was, in his opinion, now beyond doubt, that the message was a handbook for the construction of a machine. He neglected to mention that the idea of the message as a blueprint had originally been his and Arkhangelsky's, and Ellie seized the opportunity to rectify the oversight. She had talked about the subject enough over the past few months to know that both scientific and general audiences were often fascinated by the details of the unravelling of the message and tantalised by the still unproved concept of a primer. But she was unprepared for the response from this, one would expect, staid audience. Vega and she had interdigitated their presentations. As they finished, there was a sustained thunder of applause. The Soviets and Eastern European delegations applauded in unison, with a frequency of about two or three hand claps per heartbeat. The Americans and many others applauded separately, their unsynchronized clapping a sea of white noise rising from the crowd. Enveloped by an unfamiliar kind of joy, she could not resist thinking about the differences in national character, the Americans as individualists, and the Russians engaged in a collective endeavour. Also, she recalled that Americans in crowds tried to maximise their distance from their fellows, while Soviets tended to lean on each other as much as possible. Both styles of applause, the American clearly dominant, delighted her. For just a moment she permitted herself to think about her stepfather and her father. After lunch, there was a succession of other presentations on the data collection and interpretation. David Drumlin gave an extraordinarily capable discussion of a statistical analysis that he had recently performed of all previous pages of the message that referred to the new numbered diagrams. He argued that the message contained not just a blueprint for building a machine, but also descriptions of the designs and means of fabrication of components and subcomponents. In a few cases, he thought, there were descriptions of whole new industries not yet known on Earth. Ellie, mouth agape, shook her finger toward Drumlin, silently asking Valerian whether he had known about this. His lips pursed, Valerian hunched his shoulders and rotated his hands, palms up. She scanned the other delegates for some expression of emotion, but could detect mainly signs of fatigue. The depth of technical material and the necessity, sooner or later, of making political decisions were already producing strain. After the session, she complimented Drumlin on the interpretation, but asked why she had not heard of it until now. He replied, before walking away, "Oh, I didn't think it was important enough to bother you with. It was just a little something I did while you were out consulting religious fanatics." If Drumlin had been her thesis advisor, she would still be pursuing her PhD, she thought. He'd never fully accepted her. They would never share an easygoing, collegial relationship. Sighing, she wondered whether Ken had known about Drumlin's new work, but as conference co-chairman, Dehir was sitting with his Soviet opposite number on a raised dais, facing the horseshoe of delegate tears. He was, as he had been for weeks, nearly inaccessible. Drumlin was not obliged to discuss his findings with her, of course. She knew they both had been preoccupied recently. But in conversation with him, why was she always accommodating and argumentative only in extremis? A part of her evidently felt that the granting of her doctorate and the opportunity to pursue her science were still future possibilities firmly in Drumlin's hands. On the morning of the second day, a Soviet delegate was given the floor. He was unknown to her. Stefan Alexievich Baruda. The vitagraphics on her computer screen read out, "Director, Institute for Peace Studies, Soviet Academy of Sciences, Moscow. Member, Central Committee, Communist Party of the USSR." "Now we start to play hardball," she heard Michael Kitts say to Elmo Hunnicutt of the State Department. Baruda was a dapper man, wearing an elegantly tailored and impeccably fashionable Western business suit, perhaps of Italian cut. His English was fluent and almost unaccented. He had been born in one of the Baltic republics, was young to be head of such an important organization, formed to study the long-term implications for strategic policy of the deaccessioning of nuclear weapons, and was a leading example of the new wave in the Soviet leadership. "Let us be frank," Baruda was saying. "A message is being sent to us from the far reaches of space. Most of the information has been gathered by the Soviet Union and the United States. Essential pieces have also been obtained by other countries. All of those countries are represented at this conference. Any one nation, the Soviet Union, for example, could have waited until the message repeated itself several times, as we all hope it will, and fill in the many missing pieces in such a way, but it would take years, perhaps decades, and we are a little impatient. So we have all shared the data. Any one nation, the Soviet Union, for example, could place into orbit around the Earth large radio telescopes with sensitive receivers that work at the frequencies of the message. The Americans could do this as well. Perhaps Japan or France or the European Space Agency could. Then any one nation by itself could acquire all the data. Because in space, a radio telescope can point at Vega all the time. But that might be thought a hostile act. It is no secret that the United States or the Soviet Union might be able to shoot down such satellites. So perhaps for this reason, too, we have all shared the data. It is better to cooperate. Our scientists wish to exchange not only the data that they have gathered, but also their speculations, their guesses, their dreams. All you scientists are alike in that respect. I am not a scientist. My speciality is government. So I know that the nations are also alike. Every nation is cautious. Every nation is suspicious. None of us would give an advantage to a potential adversary if we could prevent it. And so there have been two opinions, perhaps more, but at least two. One that counsels exchange of all the data, and another that counsels each nation to seek advantage over the other. You can be sure the other side is seeking some advantage, they say. It is the same in most countries. The scientists have won this debate. So, for example, most of the data, although I wish to point out not all, acquired by the United States and by the Soviet Union, have been exchanged. Most of the data from all other countries have been exchanged worldwide. We are happy we have made this decision. Ellie whispered to Kitz, "This doesn't sound like hardball to me." "Stay tuned," he whispered back. "But there are other kinds of dangers. We would like now to raise one of them for the consortium to consider." Baruda's tone reminded her of Vega's at lunch the other day. What was the bee in the Soviet bonnet? "We have heard Academician Lunacharsky, Dr. Arroway, and other scientists agree that we are receiving the instructions for building a complex machine. Suppose that, as everyone seems to expect, the end of the message comes. The message recycles to the beginning, and we receive the introduction, or the English word is primer, which lets us read the message. Suppose also that we continue to cooperate fully, all of us. We exchange all the data, all the fantasies, all the dreams. Now, the beings on Vega, they are not sending us these instructions for their amusement. They want us to build a machine. Perhaps they will tell us what the machine is supposed to do, perhaps not. But even if they do, why should we believe them? So, I raise my own fantasy, my own dream. It is not a happy one. What if this machine is a Trojan horse? We build the machine at great expense, turn it on, and suddenly an invading army pours out of it. Or what if it is a doomsday machine? We build it, turn it on, and the earth blows up. Now, perhaps this is their way to suppress civilizations just emerging into the cosmos. It would not cost much. They pay only for a telegram, and the upstart civilization obediently destroys itself. What I am about to ask is only a suggestion, a talking point. I raise it for your consideration. I mean it to be constructive. On this issue, we all share the same planet. We all have the same interests. No doubt I will put it too bluntly, but here is my question. Would it be better to burn the data and destroy the radio telescopes? A commotion ensued. Many delegations asked simultaneously to be recognized. Instead, the conference co-chairman seemed mainly motivated to remind the delegates that sessions were not to be recorded or videotaped. No interviews were to be granted to the press. There would be daily press releases agreed upon by the conference co-chairman and the leaders of delegations. Even the integuments of the present discussion were to remain in this conference chamber. Several delegates asked for clarification from the chair. "If Barudi is right about a Trojan horse or a doomsday machine," shouted out a Dutch delegate, "isn't it our duty to inform the public?" But he had not been recognized, and his microphone had not been activated. They went on to other, more urgent matters. Ellie had quickly punched into the institutional computer terminal before her for an early position in the queue. She discovered that she was scheduled second after Sukhavati and before one of the Chinese delegates. Ellie knew D.V. Sukhavati slightly. A stately woman in her mid-40s, she was wearing a Western coiffure, high heels, sling-back pumps, and an exquisite silk sari. Originally trained as a physician, she'd become one of the leading Indian experts in molecular biology, and now shared her time between King's College, Cambridge, and the Tata Institute in Bombay. She was one of a handful of Indian fellows of the Royal Society of London, and was said to be well-placed politically. They had last met a few years before at an international symposium in Tokyo, before receipt of the message had eliminated the obligatory question marks in the titles of some of their scientific papers. Ellie had sensed a mutual affinity, due only in part to the fact that they were among the few women participating in scientific meetings on extraterrestrial life. "I recognize that academician Barudi has raised an important and sensitive issue," Sukhavati began, "and it would be foolish to dismiss the Trojan horse possibility carelessly. Given most of recent history, this is a natural idea, and I'm surprised it took so long to be raised. However, I would like to caution against such fears. It is unlikely in the extreme that the beings on a planet of the star Vega are exactly at our level of technological advance. Even on our planet, cultures do not evolve in lockstep. Some start earlier, others later. I recognize that some cultures can catch up, at least technologically. When there were high civilizations in India, China, Iraq, and Egypt, there were at best Iron Age nomads in Europe and Russia and Stone Age cultures in America. But the differences in the technologies will be much greater in the present circumstances. The extraterrestrials are likely to be far ahead of us. Certainly more than a few hundred years farther along, perhaps thousands of years ahead of us, or even millions. Now, I ask you to compare that with the pace of human technological advancement in the last century. I grew up in a tiny village in South India. In my grandmother's time, the treadle sewing machine was a technological wonder. What would beings who are thousands of years ahead of us be capable of? Or millions? As a philosopher in our part of the world once said, the artifacts of a sufficiently advanced extraterrestrial civilization would be indistinguishable from magic. We can pose no threat to them whatever. They have nothing to fear from us, and that will be true for a very long time. This is no confrontation between Greeks and Trojans, who were evenly matched. This is no science fiction movie where beings from different planets fight with similar weapons. If they wish to destroy us,
They can certainly do so, with or without our cooperate. But at what cost? Someone interrupted from the floor. Don't you see? That's the point. Baruda is saying our television broadcasts to space are their notice that it's time to destroy us, and the message is the means. Punitive expeditions are dear. The message is cheap.
Eddie could not make out who had shouted out this intervention. It seemed to be someone in the British delegation. His remarks had not been amplified by the audio system because, again, the speaker had not been recognized by the chair. But the acoustics in the conference hall were sufficiently good that he could be heard perfectly well. Dehir, in the chair, tried to keep order. Abukimov leaned over and whispered something to an aide.
"You think there is a danger in building the machine," Sukhavati replied. "I think there is a danger in not building the machine. I would be ashamed of our planet if we turned our back on the future. Your ancestors," she shook a finger at her interlocutor, "were not so timid when they first set sail for India or America."
The meeting was getting to be full of surprises, Ellie thought. Although she doubted whether Clive or Raleigh were the best role models for present decision-making. Perhaps Sukhavati was only tweaking the British for past colonial offences. She waited for the green speaker's light on her console to illuminate, indicating that her microphone was activated.
"Mr. Chairman," she found herself in this formal and public posture, addressing Dehir, whom she had hardly seen in the last few days. They had arranged to spend tomorrow afternoon together during a break in the meeting, and she felt some anxiety about what they would say. "Oops, wrong thought," she thought.
"Mr. Chairman," she continued, "I believe we can shed some light on these two questions, the Trojan horse and the doomsday machine. I had intended to discuss this tomorrow morning, but it certainly seems relevant now." On her console, she punched in the code numbers for a few of her slides. The great mirrored hall darkened.
"Dr. Lunacharsky and I are convinced that these are different projections of the same three-dimensional configuration. We showed the entire configuration in computer-simulated rotation yesterday. We think, though we can be sure, that this is what the interior of the machine will look like. There is as yet no clear indication of scale. Maybe it's a kilometre across, maybe it's sub-microscopic, but notice these five objects, evenly spaced around the periphery of the main interior chamber, inside the dodecahedron. Now here is a close-up of one of them. They're the only things in the chamber that look at all recognizable. Now, this appears to be an ordinary, overstuffed armchair, perfectly configured for a human being. It's very unlikely that extraterrestrial beings evolved on another quite different world would resemble us sufficiently to share our preferences in living room furniture. Now, here, look at this close-up. It looks like something from my mother's spare room when I was growing up.
Indeed, it almost seemed to have flowered slipcovers. A small flutter of guilt entered her mind. She had neglected to call her mother before leaving for Europe, and, if truth be told, had called her only once or twice since the message was received. "Ellie, how could you?" she remonstrated with herself. She looked again at the computer graphics. The five-fold symmetry of the dodecahedron was reflected in the five interior chairs, each facing a pentagonal surface.
"So it is our contention, Dr. Lunacharsky and I, that the five chairs are meant for us, for people. That would mean that the interior chamber of the machine is only a few meters across. The exterior, perhaps 10 or 20 meters across. The technology is undoubtedly formidable, but we don't think we're talking about building something the size of a city, or as complex as an aircraft carrier. We might very well be able to build this, whatever it is, if we all work together. What I'm trying to say is that you don't put chairs inside a bomb.
I don't think this is a doomsday machine or a Trojan horse. I agree with what Dr. Sukhavati said, or maybe only implied. The idea that this is a Trojan horse is itself an indication of how far we have to go. Again, there was an outburst. This time De Heer made no effort to stop it. Indeed, he actually turned the complainant's microphone on. It was the same delegate who had interrupted Sukhavati a few minutes earlier, Philip Bedenbaugh of the United Kingdom, a Labour Party minister in the shaky coalition government. "Simply doesn't understand what our concern is. If it was literally a wooden horse, we would not be tempted to bring the alien device within the city gates. Now, we've read our Homer, but flounce it up with some upholstery, and our suspicions are allayed. Why? Because we are being flattered, or bribed. Now, there's an historic adventure implied. There's the promise of new technologies. There's a hint of acceptance by, well, how to put it, greater beings. But I say, no matter what lofty fantasies the radio astronomers may entertain, if there's even a tiny chance the machine is a mean of destruction, it should not be built. Better, as the Soviet delegate has proposed, to burn the data tapes and make the construction of radio telescopes a capital crime." The meeting was becoming unruly. Scores of delegates were electronically queuing for authorization to speak. The hubbub rose to a subdued roar that reminded Ellie of her years of listening to radio astronomical static. A consensus did not seem readily within reach, and the co-chairmen were clearly unable to restrain the delegates. As the Chinese delegate rose to speak, the vitagraphics were slow to appear on Ellie's screen, and she looked around for help. She had no idea who this man was either. Nguyen Bobby Bui, a National Security Council staffer now assigned to De Heer, leaned over and said, "Shi Kuo Mu's his name, spelled X-I, pronounced Shi, heavy dude, born on the Long March, volunteer as a teenager in Korea, government official, mainly political, knocked down for a nine count in the Cultural Revolution. Central Committee member now, very influential, been in the news lately, also directs Chinese archaeological digging." Shi Kuo Mu was a tall, broad-shouldered man, around 60. The wrinkles on his face made him seem older, but his posture and physique gave him an almost youthful appearance. He wore his tunic, buttoned at the collar, in the fashion that was as obligatory for Chinese political leaders as three-piece suits were for American governmental leaders, the president, of course, excepted. The vitagraphics now came through on her console, and she could remember having read a long article about Shi Kuo Mu in one of the video news magazines. "If we are frightened," he was saying, "we will do nothing. That will delay them a little, but remember, they know we are here. Our television arrives at their planet every day. They are reminded of us. Have you looked at our television programs? They will not forget us. If we do nothing, and if they are worried about us, they will come to us, machine or no machine. We cannot hide from them. If we had kept quiet, we would not face this problem. If we had cable television only and no big military radar, then maybe they would not know about us. But now is too late. We cannot go back. Our course is set. If you are seriously frightened about this machine destroying the Earth, do not build it on the Earth. Build it somewhere else. Then, if it is a doomsday machine and blows up a world, it will not be our world. But this will be very expensive, probably too expensive. Or if we are not so frightened, build it in some isolated desert. You could have a very big explosion in the Takapi wasteland in Jinying province and still kill nobody. And if we are not frightened at all, we can build it in Washington or Moscow or Beijing or in this beautiful city. In ancient China, Vega and two nearby stars were called Chinoi. It means the young woman with the spinning wheel. It is an auspicious symbol, a machine to make new clothes for the people of the earth. We have received an invitation, a very unusual invitation. Maybe it is to go to a banquet. The earth has never been invited to a banquet before. It would be impolite to refuse.